You know, there's this old saying from the New Testament about not praying in public, right? And the idea is that if you're going to commune for the higher good, you should do it in private, because otherwise you're warping your ethic in some sense by demonstrating how virtuous you are to the world.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, you know, you go out there with a stick and a sign on it that says, "I'm against poverty." It's like, yeah, no kidding, man. Really. Like, who's for poverty? No one's for poverty. So it's an abdication of responsibility with the mask of social virtue. Mm-hmm. You want to solve a difficult problem is you figure out how to get along with your brother, the one you've been fighting with for 5 years, or see if you can staple your family back together. See if you can stop fighting with your girlfriend and have a relationship that lasts for more than 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like there are things that you should be doing in the confines of your own life that are private and humble that would constitute genuine accomplishments, and those are the things that you should attend to. And no one's going to come along and say, "Hey, you know, good job, you're changing the world," because it's private, but it's real. And people don't do that. And so no, I don't trust the activist ethos at all.
Hmm.
I think everything about it is superficial and trendy and too easy, and it externalizes the blame. The evil is always elsewhere, which is a dreadful mistake to make, because the evil isn't elsewhere. That's the thing that you understand when you're wise. Is the evil is not elsewhere. It's you, because you're not everything you could be.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, you should work on that before going and telling someone else that maybe they're not who they should be.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's, you know, I don't buy it. It's too easy. It's far too easy. And it's too public.
Mm-hmm.
And it's too self-congratulatory. And then there's the murderous, like, Marxist element, which, you know, I'm always often inclined to mention.
So certainly I think you've identified certain causes where the public element of trying to do good, or the self-congratulatory version of trying to do good, could be harmful. But do you think there are cases? For instance, I'm thinking of policy, influencing policy, being a policymaker. It seems like something like that, public policy, could be used to eliminate some unnecessary suffering, but would involve a more public domain, something where you are trying to attract followers, trying to attract praise from other people.
Look, if you've established yourself in the world as a credible human being, and people are asking you to enter public service because of your accomplishments, then it's time to do it. Right. But before that, it's a little on the premature side.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're just setting yourself forward as an avatar of an ideology, then there's nothing to you except, I think of it as, the chattering of various forms of demons. It's like, you're not helpful. And if you look, you want to think, okay, are you fit to lead?
Yeah.
Let's put it that way. Okay, first of all, do you know where you're going? Because that's actually one of the hallmarks of a leader. A leader knows where he's going, and maybe other people are also interested in going that way.
Mm-hmm.
But the leaders I've met have carved themselves out a personal vision, right? Mm-hmm. It's not some cookie cutter ideological solution to the ills of the planet. They've done a detailed analysis, right? They know what they're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And they're usually people, well, they've had a successful relationship. They've had a successful family. They have a couple of degrees. They've established a business. Like, they've made themselves credible in 5 or 6 dimensions. Well, then maybe you know enough about the world to dare to mess with its internal mechanisms. And if you don't have that kind of in-depth knowledge, then you should no more work on the economic systems of Western civilization than you should try to adjust the electronic systems of your automobile, because the latter is far less complex than the former. So of course there's utility in policy formulation and in government service and in all of those sorts of things. But you have to have transformed yourself, at least to some degree, into someone who's actually competent before you should even dare to do such things. You think, well, I've read some Marx and now I know how to change the world. It's like, That's a very bad idea, because the probability that you're going to take something complex that doesn't work too badly and fix it with your idiotic intervention is zero. Order surrounded by chaos, right? It's like a tree. It's like the evolutionary home of primates, the tree with the snakes on the ground. That's our landscape. Or it's the fire for tribal people and the terrors of the forest that are beyond the light that the fire casts. It's explored territory versus unexplored territory. And that's an archetype as well. That,
that's, you can't not be in a situation where that's the case. Even if you're among friends, you know, you think that's explored territory. That's not exactly right, because what happens if you're among friends is that they carefully reveal new parts of themselves all the time. So it's like they're blasting little elements of unexplored territory at you constantly. And if they don't, then what happens? You get bored and you look for new people. And we know there's empirical data on that with regards to intimate relationships, because there was a nice study done a while back showing that looking at the ratio of positive to negative emotional experiences that were most predictive of long-term relationship success. And the answer was, now obviously it depends on how you would measure an event and how you would measure positive and negative emotion, but that aside, the finding was something like, if you're in a relationship and you only have 5 positive interactions to 1 negative interaction, then the relationship will end. It's too negative. But if you have more than 11 positive interactions to 1 negative interaction, then it also ends. And you think, well, that's pretty bloody peculiar. Why in the world would that be? Don't you want like 100-to-1 positive to negative interactions? And the answer to that is, what makes you think that you want a relationship so that you can be happy? Or at least happy moment to moment. Why do you think that? It's certainly not the case. You know that too, because I bet you there's not a person in this room who hasn't rejected someone because they were too nice to them. Something like that person's no challenge. It's something like that. You want someone who, you know, you can get along with them, but now and then they bite you and you think, oh, that's interesting. You know, I didn't really expect that. And then you go and puzzle over it for a while and you torture yourself about it. And that's one of the things that keeps you really linked into the relationship. And the reason for that is that part of the reason that you want the relationship isn't so that you're happy right now. It's so that you can live a high quality life across multiple decades. And so you're looking for someone that you have to contend with, who's going to push you beyond what you already are and who's going to judge you harshly often for your limitations. Now, that'll make you angry and all of that, and resentful, and maybe you'll take your revenge and all of that, but you don't want someone who thinks you're perfect in your current form, partly because why would you want to go out with someone that deluded? So what does it mean for this symbol to emerge from, the feminine symbol, let's say, to emerge from chaos? Well, this is a picture of Venus, the goddess of love, right? And so I cut this picture out of a larger picture, and it's Venus manifesting herself in a transcendent space in the sky, in the same way that Christ did in the previous representation. And she has rays coming off her, and there's all these men who are knights kneeling in front of the image. Well, what does that mean? Well, it means that men use the image of female perfection to motivate themselves. And that's exactly right. That's precisely what they do. You see that in the Tom Sawyer story. So Tom Sawyer is about 12 years old, and he's still hanging around with his friends like Huck Finn. And this girl moves across the street, Becky, and she comes out and he's struck by her for the first time in his life. Something's changed. And the first thing he does is hop up on a picket fence and show off and balance in front of her. And he's saying, well, look at me. He's like the male bower bird building something beautiful so the female will approve of it. And it's motivation. You know, and that's something that I think modern women don't really understand about men. They don't understand that, at least to the degree that males are uncorrupted and not bitter because of being rejected, they're doing everything they can to kneel before the eternal image of the feminine and try to make themselves worthy. That's the chivalry story, right? That's what you should encourage in your partner. So out of chaos emerges this first form. It's the feminine form. It's partly the form that represents novelty as such. So, and on one hand it's promise, on the other hand it's threat. That you wouldn't believe, and I don't know, because I don't understand the situation with women as well as I understand the situation with men, obviously, being a man. But I don't know if women have any idea how paralyzing they are to especially young men. very large number of my clinical clients, but also young men I've talked to in general, are absolutely terrified of women because they're terrified of being rejected. And the terror exists in precise proportion to their attraction to the woman, which is a horrible paradoxical situation to be in. It's often why men make such fools of themselves in front of women that they're attracted to. It's because, first of all, they don't see the woman that they're attracted to. Because what the hell do they know about her? They don't see her as an individual. They see her as the manifestation of a judgmental ideal. And then it's only in establishing the relationship with the actual woman that they can start differentiating between the judgmental ideal and the actual individual woman. And that also requires a sacrifice. And the sacrifice is, you never can have an ideal woman. So to have a relationship with any woman, you have to sacrifice the relationship with the ideal woman, and you have to see the individual woman and separate her from the ideal. And that's the same thing that happens to the hero in Sleeping Beauty, right? He sees the evil queen, who actually turns into the dragon of chaos, and it's not until he can defeat her that he can establish a relationship with the actual princess. And that's exactly the case. I had one of my clients who ran this men's group, which was quite interesting. One of the things they had the initiates do, which was very intelligent, was to go out and ask 50 women in one day for their phone numbers. Why? Politely, properly, you know, it was a game, but it wasn't a stupid game. And the idea was, get over your fear of rejection. And how do you do that? By encountering it continually and continually and continually, so that you're no longer paralyzed by this. The couples who are going to get divorced, they come into the bed and breakfast, and they speak with each other quite calmly. But it's more walking on eggs calm. And while they're speaking with each other calmly, their physiology is like, they're very aroused, and so they're sort of aroused like someone who's facing a predator. So you might think of an unhappy couple as predator and prey to each other. And so the words are there mostly to stop predatory activity, not to actually communicate anything. It's just to keep the surface calm. So then you might think, well, what's under the surface? And what's under the surface, so Freud would say, it's what's under the surface is unconscious. But you can say, well, what's under the surface is one of these hierarchies that's all banged up and twisted and not in reasonable shape. And so people don't want to open the door to that. So, but they do. This is a Freudian slip. So let's say this goes to the second part of Gottman's observations. So the woman goes over to the window and she says, oh, look, there's a cardinal outside. You know, cardinals, that bright red bird, they're kind of cool looking. You know, it's kind of a trivial thing in some sense, but by the same token, it's like, it's a little positive thing, and, you know, 20 of them in a day is a good thing. Okay, so then the partner, the husband in this example, has a 2x2 matrix of choices. One is, who the hell cares about your stupid bird? Okay, so that's one. The second one is, then you go over and look at the bird, right? And the third one is, you don't make the contempt noise, but you act it out. And the fourth one is, you go over there like a civilized human being, and, you know, and that you're interacting with someone that you care for, and you take a look at the damn bird, and you're happy about it. And that's as truthful and real as you can manage. Okay, so the option, that's a Freudian slip. Right? Because what it says, there's a whole monster underneath that, and the monster is all the disorganization in this entire structure. It's like the might be, we have been tormenting each other about various things for the last 10 years, and none of them are resolved, and I'm not very happy about you for so many reasons I can't even remember all of them. And I can't enumerate them right now because that would take forever and maybe we would have a huge fight. But by the same token, I'm not going to come over there and make you happy with your stupid bird. And I'm going to indicate that subtly so you can't call me a son of a bitch because I'm just sighing and that's what I'll say if you do ask me. But I'm going to load all that up and I'm going to deliver it to you. And what's going to happen to you is because you're smart is your heart rate's going to go way up like you're being attacked. And the reason for that is you are. So what the good couples do, the couples that, you know, stay together, is they respond to each other's bids. He calls them bids. And so if one person wants to share some little trivial daily positive thing with the other
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
You know, isn't carrying around a bloody cartload of resentment and is able to respond to that in a positive way. And that way, the general interactions between the couple stay positive. But that's also because they've worked this out. Now, you know it's got to be because they work it out, because the couples who are physiologically reactive to each other, they're communicating, but there's all sorts of horror underneath the surface. And we're trying to figure out, well, what is it that's underneath the surface? What's the structure of the unconscious? Well, that's the structure of the unconscious. And it's either well-structured and functional and mutually agreed upon and as explicit as possible, or it's this, constantly.
You're in a class, it's near the beginning of the semester, you write an exam or you hand in an essay and you don't get the mark that you desired. Okay, so what are your options? Well, one option would be, so you've hit an anomaly, things didn't happen the way you wanted them to happen. And so maybe you say, geez, that was a boring and stupid class anyways, this gives me an excuse to get out, and so that's not such a negative thing. Or you think, oh, well, I really better buckle down and study, and you decide to stay in the class. So basically what you've done is maintained your framework, I'm going to work through this class, but you've decided to modify some of the subroutines that make up that frame. You say, well, I should study more next time, or I have to prioritize this class compared to other classes. So it's a micro alteration within the overarching framework. But another thing you can do is say, to hell with the class, I'll just drop it. And so the advantage to that is problem gone. The disadvantage is, well, now you have a different problem, which is, okay, fine, you drop the class, do you have another class that you can replace it with? Is that a good way of dealing with a micro failure, you know, to move up a level of analysis and throw out the whole frame? Because you could also say, well, maybe I should just drop out of university and maybe I should go hang myself, you know. Well, it's the same line of logic, it's just taken up to a higher degree of abstraction. And so, generally speaking, you don't want to solve a problem by moving up a level and wiping out the frame within which the problem was experienced. You want to do that carefully, because in principle, the frame that you were working within you'd already assigned value to it and worked at it. You've already invested in it. It's a big sacrifice to blow out the whole frame. Now, sometimes you can do it. So, anyways, what happens is, well, you get the bad grade and you're upset about it, and so you've been plunged from your happy, satiated state, let's say, into a state of relative chaos. And the chaos is, oh, I hit an obstacle, I didn't expect it, and now I don't know what to do. And so what does it mean to not know what to do? Well, it can mean I need to study harder. It can mean I should drop this course. It can mean I should major in a different subject. It could mean maybe I shouldn't be in university. It could mean maybe my future plans have been formulated badly. It can mean my future plans have been formulated badly because I don't understand myself very well and I've been telling lies about my past, right? The thing can really expand on you. And that's what the chaotic domain is. That's the re-manifestation of those things that you had considered irrelevant, right? Because when you go to pick up the exam, you've got your identity as a competent student intact. You're not questioning whether you should be in the course or whether you should be in that major or whether you should be in university. None of that. That's all in the implicitly accepted category. And as soon as the anomalous event emerges, all of those things that you had rendered axiomatic start to become questionable. And that's like the shark coming up from the depths to pull you down. And that's the classic way of representing that and of symbolizing it. That's Jonah and the whale, for example. So it's something is manifests itself from the deep unknown and pulls you under, like an alligator at a water hole, which is, I'm sure, one of the sources from which we derived that particular kind of mythological representation. Because you could imagine that when we were on the veldt after living on trees. We had to go down to the dam water holes, and you've watched enough nature programs to know what a Nile crocodile can do to a water buffalo. It's not pretty. And so to go down to the water, the chaotic water and the source of all life as well, right, is to risk an encounter with the terrible thing that lurks in the depths. And so we use that as a central metaphor for mapping the sorts of things that happen to us in a much more abstract space. And you know that because one of the things you're going to do, let's say that the professor, there's a professor obviously who gave you the bad grade. Okay, so one logical presupposition is that you're in some sense insufficient in relationship to the course. But another logical and instantaneous categorization is to throw that person into the category of malevolent predator. And you'll do that by becoming upset and cursing the person in your imagination. Piaget was very interested in how you produce structures that enable you to regulate yourself, because you're like a kind of a colony of strange sub-animals that have to figure out how to get along so that you can sort of be one thing. You kind of learn that, I would say, between the ages of 2 and 4 as you're being socialized. You know how erratic 2-year-olds are. I mean, they're a blast, and it's part because they're erratic. It's like they're unbelievably happy, and then they're unbelievably hungry, and then they're really hot, and then they're really upset and crying, you know, and then they're really scared. It's like, and all of that's just untrammeled, and so it's really fun to be around them, especially when they're happy, because they're so happy that it's just, you know, you don't ever get to be that happy. And so it's nice to be around a 2-year-old because you can kind of feel that again, you know. And a lot of one of the horrible things about being a parent is that you spend a tremendous amount of your time making your child less happy. And the reason for that is that positive emotion is very impulsive, you know, and, you know, because everybody says, well, you should be happy. It's like, well, no. When you're happy, you're actually quite stupid. And so, because happiness makes you impulsive, happiness says, hey, things are really good right now, get what you can while the getting's good. And so, if you're hyper-optimistic, manic, we'll say, it's like every stock investment looks like a really good stock investment. It's like you won't spend all your money because look at, there's those wonderful things everywhere and you could do such great things with them. And then, you know, you spend all your money and then you crash and you think, oh God, my life's over, you know, because I just spent all my money on all this useless stuff, and it's all under the grip of impulsive positive emotion, you know. And so When you're telling your kids to be quiet and settle down, it isn't because they're making a lot of noise being in pain. It's because they're running around like wild baboons having a blast and disrupting things like mad, you know. And so, well, you got kids, you got to settle down, you know, like quit having so much fun. And it's kind of awful that you do that, but you do. And that's because the emotions and the motivations have to be brought into like a relationship with one another within the person, so that, you know, one thing I remember with my son, who is quite, he's quite disagreeable by temperament, which is actually a good thing as far as I'm concerned, although it brings its own challenges. And so with my daughter, when she was misbehaving, she was pretty agreeable. And, you know, if she was misbehaving, I could basically just look at her and then she'd quit, you know. But my son, it was like, that was just nothing. You're looking at me, it's like, no, that's just not going to go anywhere, man. And so then I'd like tell him to stop, and that really wasn't having much of an effect either. He just sort of maybe laugh or run away or whatever. I mean, he was a tough little rat. And, you know, what I would do with him is he would be doing something and I'd interfere and he'd get upset and, you know, angry. And so then I'd get him to sit on the steps, and I told him, and this is when he was about 2, I said, look, you're going to sit on the steps, that's time out. You're going to sit on the steps until you've got control of yourself and you can come back and be and play the family game again. I basically said, be a civilized human being and then you're welcome again. And so he'd sit on the steps. It was so interesting to watch because he was just enraged. He'd sit there. Like, have you ever seen a 2-year-old have a temper tantrum? It's really quite the bloody phenomena. If you ever saw an adult do that, you'd call 911 right away. It's like, oh my God. And I've seen adults do that, you know, because people say with borderline personality disorder will have temper tantrums. And it's like, man, you want to be about 30 feet away from that person. That's for sure. It's really, but in kids, it's like, well, first of all, they're only this long, so how much trouble can they really cause? But it's like, you know, they're just completely gone. They're like on the floor, their face is red, they're just furious, like way more furious than you ever get if you're even vaguely socialized. They're just outraged and they're kicking and hitting the ground, and like it's like a little epileptic fit of anger, you know. They're completely controlled by their rage. And we took care of one kid for a while who, he was actually a pushover, that kid. You could get him to behave by, you know, kind of shaking your finger at him, but his mother thought he was really tough because he had her figured out. And one of the things he would do is have a temper tantrum, and during the temper tantrum, he would hold his bloody breath until he turned blue. It's like, try that. Like, you know, as that's your homework. Go home and have a temper tantrum, and while you're doing it, hold your breath until you actually turn blue. It's like, you won't be able to do it. You don't have the willpower of a two-year-old, that's for sure. That little varmint, man, he'd just have a fit, and then he'd hold his breath, and then he'd turn blue. It was like, wow, that's amazing. And we would just like let him do it, and you know, he'd turn blue and everybody would be gone and he'd come out of it, you know, and it didn't work, so he just quit doing it. I think he did it like twice, and he figured out, oh well, that's a lot of work for very little outcome. And you know, it's not like two-year-olds are stupid. They're not stupid. They're probably smarter than you, but they're not civilized by any stretch of the imagination. And so anyways, back to my son, I'd put him on the steps and he'd be like, just like enraged and trying to get himself together, you know. And I'd wait a few, I got a strict rule, which was, as soon as you're done, you're welcome again. So it's completely under your control. You get yourself calmed down, you come and talk to me again. If you're calm enough so I like you, then you're welcome back in the family. No grudge, nothing. And so it's harder than you think. Like, people think they like their kids. It's like, don't be thinking that. They're hard to like. They're little monsters, and they're very, very pushy and provocative. And so lots of parents do not like their children, and they do terrible things to them their whole life. So it's no joke, and it's very common. And, you know, that was Freud's observation, fundamental observation, that a lot of psychopathology is rooted in the family, and you can be sure of that, you know. And when you hear about some mother who's done something terrible to her child, which happens reasonably frequently, you know perfectly well that she has very terrible capacity to discipline. The child's just provoked her and provoked her and provoked her and provoked her and provoked her. And it just happens to be a day where her new boyfriend left and she's quite hungover and she got fired. And it's like, that's the wrong day to provoke her. And then she does something that is not good. And you read about it and you think, well, how could that happen? How could anyone do that? Well, that's how they do it. And so, and kids are very provocative, just like little chimps. The adolescents will like throw little pebbles and sticks at the sleeping larger males and bug them. And that teasing, which it is, that teasing turns into full-fledged dominance challenge behavior once the adolescent males get big enough to do it. And so when you're being provoked by a child, which they provoke you all the time, they're trying to figure out, well, just where are you exactly? What happens if I do this? What happens if I do this? You know, and how else are they going to figure it out? Anyways, he'd sit on the steps and just, he's just enraged and trying to control himself, and I'd watch that, and then, you know, I'd come back after about 2 minutes or whatever, and he'd still be, I'd say, well, you know, have you got yourself under control? Are you ready to get off the steps? And he'd go, no, not yet. And then, you know, he'd get himself under control, and then he'd come back and, you know, he'd be contrite. And then I would like him right away, you know. You got to watch that, you know, because you don't like being dominated by a two-year-old. No one does. And so if the child hasn't mastered himself and started to act in accordance with the prevailing social norms, you won't like them. Well, you think, oh yeah, I will, because, you know, I'm a good person. It's like, no, you won't. And no, you're not a good person, so don't be thinking about that at all. It's just not true. So when he was contrite, then he'd come, and then, you know, we'd just go on like nothing had happened. Because that's what you want to do, right? As soon as you get compliance, especially if the compliance is in the best interest of the child, you want to reward it instantly, right? That's the right thing to do. Because so then, and you could just see him gaining control over himself. And so really what was happening is, in his brain, we'll say there was a war between the psyche, the ego, that was starting to become integrated, you know, and starting to become a continuous person, an identity. And it's fragile in two-year-olds, and it can be disrupted all the time, and it is. That's why they're so hyper-emotional. It's fragile, that little ego, and it doesn't have a lot of power. And so what you want to do is reward it when it wins. You know, it's when he gets control over the underlying motivations, you want to say, hey, good work, man, good work, kid. You did it, you know, you got yourself under control. Way to be. And the kid's really happy about that because it's actually not that much fun to have a temper tantrum. It's exhausting. You know, it takes you over.